Happy Rohatsu, everybody. Happy Awakening Day. It's funny. Rohatsu basically means day eight. Not very auspicious sounding, but everyone, of course, in the Japanese Zen world knows exactly what it means. So happy day eight. Under that tree that he sat, as Kate talked about last week, feels like last week we did a lot of sitting. Yesterday, Shakyamuni, Buddha, Siddhartha, just before he awakened, dropped all his stories. He dropped all his stories and realized his true nature. And this is our practice that we continue on today. We come and sit. We work throughout our daily life as much as we can. We drop our stories and we realize our true nature. As I was listening to Kate describes Siddhartha's kind of journey before he wound up sitting under that Bodhi tree, I was thinking, you know, it's really much like our own life. It's because, like Siddhartha, most of us have had fairly comfortable lives. Fairly comfortable, you know. At least we grew up with enough food, most of us, enough warm clothing, education. Maybe we had, you know, got good medicine or medical treatment when we were ill. We were protected from, you know, outside dangers. And just like Siddhartha, we were also entertained by our virtual storytellers, musicians and dancing girls. And then, just as in the story of Siddhartha, something arises in our own life. Some tragedy, some loss, or maybe some kind of growing discontent. And we become more and more aware that the world is not as we wish it to be, and that we cannot make the world give us what we want, always, and we cannot make the world take away what we don't want. We come to understand our life as it is, meaning much, maybe most, out of our personal control. And so we begin that long journey, like Siddhartha did, looking for answers for questions that maybe we can't even quite articulate, but we know we must seek. And we try and bring forth the courage and fortitude to do so, just as Siddhartha did. Because if you remember, as Kate said yesterday, you know, the first practices he did were not fruitful. They didn't answer his deep longing. And that's what I really admire most, I think, about Siddhartha, before he becomes the Buddha, is he had profound patience and great courage to keep on questioning and keep seeking when the first practices and people he met didn't quite answer what he needed to know. He didn't go back. You know, he didn't go back to the palace and, you know, start watching Netflix. I mean, I do sometimes. I go back home. He didn't indulge again in good food, music, and dancing girls. He didn't give in to the seduction of kingship. you know, of power or drugs or all those other things that were possible and are possible today. And so one of our challenges is not to give in to the seduction of the material world that we live in, not to believe in the kind of tsunami of advertising that our life has meaning and happiness only in our acquisitions, in our iPhone XS. Is that the latest one? Or designer jeans or kind of cool French fashions. It's not easy. Yeah, the world is, especially this modern world, so full of seductions, so easy to be pulled one way or another. And then, as Kate said yesterday, you know, Siddhartha was visited by Mara. You know, all these Mara coming and trying to distract him, pull him off course. And then Mara's daughters coming and trying the same as well. But after various temptations and delusions, all those things had kind of finally quieted in Siddhartha. He continued to sit and entered deeply into the truth of his life, into the reality of his life. And according to the text that we have, that maybe the mythic story we have of him, he meditated for 7 days, and throughout the last and seventh night, according to the sutta, the early texts, it went like this. Quote from the early texts. I truly made effort and endeavor. My thought was firm and undistracted. My body was tranquil and passive. And my mind was concentrated. I was free of desires and unwholesome thoughts. In this manner, my mind became concentrated, purified, cleansed, without defilement, pliable, established, and unmovable. Maybe you experienced some of that last night. I hope we all had a little taste of something like that. So at last, for Siddhartha, the conditions for seeing the nature of reality are completely present. This lucid quality of mind. Siddhartha's mind and heart are settled, undisturbed by worry or judgment. They're focused on the present moment. He is completely present with his life. And then, in this state, he directs his attention to his own life. What is this life? So, kind of goes like this, again according to these old texts. So throughout the first watch of the night, Siddhartha gained insight into the arising and passing away of things. He saw his former lives and came to realize the consequences of his speech, thoughts, and actions that had led him all the way to the present moment. So in other words, karma, right? He saw the consequences of his speech and actions. And in the Zen tradition, you know, we actually don't talk much about reincarnation at all. And we can find a lot more about that in the Tibetan lineages if you are interested in exploring that more. But in Zen, we tend to understand that what we call this life is not an unbroken thread, but we are being born and dying every moment. And what we conventionally call our life is really a myriad lives that kind of flash in and out. Born and die, born and die, born and die. One moment, and now it's gone. And now we have this moment. And it kind of makes sense to me because I've noticed that the 2-year-old Michael, or the 12-year-old, or the 22-year-old Michael are completely gone. I can't find them anywhere. And the Michael that was maybe angry yesterday was happy last week or frightened at a near car accident last month, that Michael too is gone. All things are being born and dying moment by moment. And truly seeing this is our freedom, because then we see, there is nothing to hang on to. Truly seeing this teaching instructs us how to really love by letting each thing really be what it is and then letting it go, not trying to keep it that way or hang on to it. So that was the first watch of the night. Siddhartha was really smoking at this point, right? Because he's like going through all these amazing insights in one night. So during the second watch of the night, he directed his mind to the lives of others and saw a rising and falling of all living beings according to the results of their karma. He saw the shape of all life. He saw the unfolding of reality. And again, here's a little quote from the early texts. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I directed my mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearing of beings. I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy in their destinations. I understood how beings pass on according to their intentions. So all arises and passes away according to myriad causes and conditions. Kind of like high school physics, right? And one of those conditions that the Buddha is talking about here is karma. One of those conditions is karma. There's many others. And that's something in the West we tend to get a bit muddled about. The Buddha is really clear in other texts that there are many forces that shape us. Karma is but one. Karma, the Buddha said, arises from the Pali word is saitana, meaning volitions or motivations, your intentions. That's karma. And there's that famous phrase in the Dhammapada, one of the early collections of sayings of the Buddha, which you've probably heard in one form or another. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, just as the cart wheel follows the hoof of the ox. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. So in other words, one's life situation can be transformed by transforming the motivations of one's actions here and now. And this too is a foundation of our freedom. We cannot magically change our present, but we can plant wholesome seeds for our future. And that's our freedom. In other words, in the present moment, we have the freedom and, I would say, the responsibility to take volitional action from our wholesome intentions. And that's one reason why we really emphasize our precepts. Because our precepts are one tool that will really check and help us. Is this a wholesome intention? So the Buddha taught a path of action and responsibility, I think, in a very realistic way. But it goes on, because there's the third watch of the night. And on the third watch of the night, he saw the morning star arise, and at this moment, his mind became illuminated. Again, a little quote. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, that this is suffering, that this is the origin of suffering, that this is the cessation of suffering, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So it's at this point the Buddha realizes, you know, the dependent arising of all existence. Everything is woven together. He fully understood what he later called, or what we later call, I guess, maybe the Four Noble Truths. And he understood the nature of suffering, or the nature of dukkha, the dissatisfaction that we all experience and how it arises and why it arises. He understood also how it ends, how we can develop a path to lead to the cessation of suffering. And he understood the nature of non-self. I mean, that's a load, right, of stuff. One night. So another quote, as the Buddha talks about this. When I realized this, my mind was freed from desire. My mind was freed from ignorance. And as I became free, I realized that I was free. This was the third wisdom obtained at the end of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, light arose. Isn't that beautiful? I love that. Light arose. Now, I must confess, I always a little bit dread Rohatsu. And it's not just because we have to stay up all night doing nothing. It's because when we talk about Rohatsu, that's whatever happened on the last day of the Buddha, that nature of awakening, I stumble. How do I talk about the awakening of Siddhartha and what it has to do with us so many centuries later and half a world away from the Buddha's homeland? And as you're probably all aware, in the Zen tradition, teachers have a strong practice or tradition or maybe block of never talking about awakening. Right? We just don't talk about it. And while it's true, you know, many of the Zen stories involve situations of awakening, the literature always refrains from describing it. They simply say, oh, he stubbed his toe and had great awakening. That's it. Right? And we're left wondering, what? What? Many of the traditional koans, of course, end with a monk awakening. A fingers raised, a shout given, a nose pulled. Some strange, bizarre reply given to a Dharma question, suddenly, in that instant, the monk was awakened. Okay. So here's an example from one of the collections of koans. One that seems pretty pedestrian, I guess. So once a monk made a request of the great master Zhaozhou. Zhaozhou is like this shining beacon in the amongst the Zen ancestors. So this monk comes up to Zhaozhou and says, I have just entered the monastery. Please give me instructions, master. Zhaozhou said, have you had your breakfast? Yes, I have, replied the monk. Then Zhaozhou replied, a wash your bowls. The monk had great insight. If only it was that easy, eh? If only the ancient teachers would have left us a little bit more to kind of parse it a little, figure it out. But they didn't. And yet, you know, when I reflect on my own years of practice, I am grateful now that my teachers never filled my head with great tales of awakening experiences, or gave a kind of pedantic explanation about what awakening may be, because that would have been of no help at all. And yet it's also true to have no vision is not much help either. You need some kind of vision, but you don't need much. I remember many years ago when I first did a week-long retreat down at Green Gulch, and Norman Fisher was leading it at that point. And I was all excited. I came into Norman Tadoksa and I said, wow, you know, I had this experience. It felt like my whole head filled the zendo. And Norman said, don't worry, it'll pass. In our world, our modern world of striving, we can easily fall into the trap of adding awakening to our bucket list. I remember reading Chogyam Trungpa coined that phrase, spiritual materialism, kind of approaching our spiritual life the same way we would approach buying a car, right, or getting our teeth whitened, looking for the best deal, easiest way, getting it over with, moving on then to the next item on our bucket list. You might imagine that there is such a thing as awakening. But in the Buddhist tradition, awakening is not a thing. It's not a noun. It's more like a verb. A Suzuki Roshi, the Japanese Zen teacher who brought our particular form of practice to America, said this, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity. And Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who brought, again, this particular stream of Zen practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s, Dogen wrote this, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. In other words, deluded people have delusions about realization. Right? It's going to be like this, right? It's going to be like this. And Buddhas have great realization about delusion. Buddhas have great realization about delusion, right? Buddhists see the stories that we tell ourselves over and over again about what the world is. But I suppose we all have our stories or delusions about realization or awakening. It's natural that we would have delusions about some wonderful realm of awakening that exists at some other place, at some point in the future. Like watching a sci-fi movie, right? Can imagine the future, flying cars. And, you know, in our state of unhappiness, we feel the need, we feel there's something we need to get there, to get to a place of happiness. We need awakening. We need to transcend. We need to become somebody other than who we are. So when you realize you're thinking those kind of thoughts like this, please do not despair. For this is actually, this kind of realization that you're thinking these thoughts is a kind of enlightened activity. It's like seeing the stories you're telling yourself. Is that making sense? We take up the practice of acknowledging the ways in which we think we are not at a place or time of awakening. This is part of our practice. Telling ourselves, oh, I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. Because maybe you are. Maybe you are already an awakened being. I'll come back to that in a moment here. In another text that Dogen wrote, called Only a Buddha and a Buddha, Dogen wrote this: Buddha Dharma cannot be known by a person. Since olden times, no ordinary person has realized the Buddha Dharma, indicating that we cannot know awakening. We cannot describe it with a set of adjectives or descriptive phrase, like we would the food at a new restaurant or a recent travel adventure we've had. It is unknowable in that way, because awakening goes beyond. Let me give you another quote from Dogen here. When you realized Buddha Dharma, you don't think, oh, this is the realization I expected. Realization is not like your conception of it. Accordingly, realization cannot take place as previously conceived. When you realize Buddha Dharma, you do not consider how realization came about. Reflect on this. What you think one way or another before realization is not a help for realization. Because realization doesn't depend on thought, but it comes forth far beyond them. I think it's a little bit like getting married. You know, you have this, you know, if you've never been married, you think, oh, married life is going to be like this, right? And then you get married. And you ask anyone who's married, right, was it exactly the way you thought it was going to be? I think it's a little bit like that, you know. So, Dogen, in that quote I just read, cautions us not to get entangled in thoughts about awakening. It's not because the thoughts are inherently bad, but because they are distractions from our practice. You know, I've noticed in myself at various times really strong longing to leave behind the vicissitudes of this life, especially when nothing seems to be going right. And many traditional religions offer, you know, a possibility, you know, this paradise or heaven, Valhalla, you know, some place where there are only the highest qualities of love, compassion, purity, joy, beer. And these can be taken as places of escape, though, from the challenges of our life. Like any other kind of fantasy we have. I remember when I was a really young teenager, I used to fantasize that a flying saucer would one day take me away from the troubling life that I had as a young teenager. Is awakening another escape? Is that how we look at awakening? Get me out of here. Suzuki Roshi, who I think had a really wonderful sense of humor, once said, "You may get enlightened and not like it." Ever think of that? So, let's take a few moments right now and consider, what are you seeking in your practice? Do you seek a form of transcendence? In some way, going outside and beyond this world? Do you seek maybe a calm abiding in deep awareness, free from the frustrations of this life? In other words, some state or place that's kind of beyond the messiness of daily life. These are kind of views of like awakenings, like a state, right? A state of being. That's one way. Sometimes we fall into that trap. But consider this. Perhaps awakening is a way of fully being with your life moment after moment. Each moment freely, in each moment freely meeting your life, doing what's called for, and fully receiving the result. No escape. Or consider this. Perhaps awakening has always been here, intimate with us, all along, kind of like the beating of our heart, or the in and out of our breath. But we've always looked for it elsewhere. Or consider this. Perhaps awakening flashes like lightning and shakes like thunder, and then it's gone. And then comes back again another time. Or perhaps, as Suzuki Roshi wrote once, it's like walking in a mist, unaware your clothes are gradually getting wetter and wetter. What is awakening? Dogen describes it in a poetic way like this. He uses the word enlightenment. He says, enlightenment is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the entire sky, enlightenment does not divide you. Just as the moon does not break the water, you cannot hinder enlightenment. Just as a drop of water does not hinder the moon in the sky. As you probably know, after the great awakening that the Buddha experienced, he wasn't sure what he was going to do. I mean, he could have gone back to the palace. He could have just continued on wandering around. But he didn't. He taught. He continued to live and teach until he was an old man. And there are many, many stories about his teaching and his life. But I hope the stories that you've heard this weekend about Siddhartha's awakening will be of some aid in your own journey. To know that you're not alone. That you're part of a long lineage of those who also have taken this long journey to awakening, and to some degree, I think this weekend, we have all awakened to the true vastness of our being. It may not seem like that at the moment, but go outside and ask a tree. A big tree. What is the vastness of being? And that tree will show you. And then we come back and we practice some more. because our practice continues endlessly. Well, maybe I'll stop there. Thank you.